by the lack of inability of councils to build and invest in homes. The policy of not allowing councils to build homes, that is what's been problematic, because it's been over decades and not over a few years. What we have now in places like my own borough, where we have a good council that is building good quality homes, we bucked the trend and we sought to build council homes, and we sought to find ways to do that and ensure that we do not sell off council land. But where we have planning, where we give planning permissions to the developers, where they've got their own private land, what unfortunately has been created historically over time is the notion of poor doors. We have a policy of 50% of that must be affordable. Affordable meaning, you know, social rent properties. And what they do is they build that integral to the development, but they build it on the side or at the back, and that's where the creation of poor doors happens.
Of course, you're in Jeremy Corbyn's borough, and he's pledged to end the housing crisis. But I want to talk about this notion now in the film of social cleansing, which seems to be a contentious, controversial term, which means that low-income workers are being driven out of the capital, London, because of the soaring rents and the interests of corporations, of course, and real estate agents. What do we learn in the film about this? The
film's very good on gentrification and how neighbourhoods have changed rapidly over the last 10, 15, 20 years. So, you know, social housing is of less concern than attracting middle-class renters with lots of disposable income who can afford coffee and hummus and all the treats of living in the inner cities. But you know, there is a degree to which housing policy seems to have been skewed specifically, almost exclusively, towards that particular demographic. And of course, that, you know, drives out people who are originally living there. And you know, that's one of the many big issues that this film addressed.
Well, part of that was, you know, the whole huge banking crisis that happened. You know, what happened after the banking crisis was in London, then London's property market was then used as the place where people invest. And so what you've got is overseas investors purchasing land and property, never ever living in those properties and creating a this and them scenarios and situations. What is a disgrace is when it's set against that. So you've already got that as a problem going on. Set against that is when councils have got land and homes in council control. What is a disgrace is councils then selling that off in some kind of partnership with the private sector.
It is such a complex issue.
It is.
Unfortunately, we're running out of time in this program. And just final 30 seconds to Mike. Would you recommend this documentary?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, we're now in a situation where the Evening Standard can run a front page about house prices going up as though that's some great triumph. To me, it looks more and more like a tragedy, and this film absolutely reflects that.
Well, thank you very much for your time and joining the show. And I'm afraid that's it for this episode of Doc Review. Thank you to both my guests and to you.
We are with you. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
Limelight. The potential illegality of the Israeli regime military recruitment in Canada is embarrassing, and promoting a foreign army rests uneasily with even right-wing nationalist thinking, which is generally sympathetic to an anti-Palestinian outlook. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by the staff of Palestine Chronicle. This article is published under the heading Campaign to Oppose Israeli Regime Military Recruitment in Canada Receives Boost. Stay tuned for more. The campaign to oppose illegal Israeli regime military recruitment in Canada has received a significant boost. A parliamentary petition calling for an investigation into IDF recruitment has quickly surpassed the number of signatures required to be presented in the House of Commons. Submitted by Rabbi David Mivasser and sponsored by NDP MP Matthew Green, the petition calls upon the Minister of Justice to undertake a thorough investigation of those who have recruited or facilitated recruiting for the Israeli regime forces and if warranted, lay charges against those involved in recruiting and encouraging recruiting for the IDF. In 48 hours, over 1,000 individuals have signed the petition, which is twice what's required for it to be read in the Parliament. The government then has to respond. The petition is part of a multifaceted campaign that began in the fall with a formal complaint, an open letter signed by Noam Chomsky, Roger Waters, filmmaker Ken Loach, author Ian Martell, former MP Jim Manley, poet Al Jones, and more than 150 others. The letter called on the federal government to apply charges under the Foreign Enlistment Act against those recruiting Canadians for the Israeli regime military. It is a crime to recruit anyone for a foreign military or to encourage any person to serve in a foreign military. The Foreign Enlistment Act states, any person who within Canada recruits or otherwise includes any person or body of persons to enlist or to accept any commission or engagement in the armed forces of any foreign state or other armed forces operating in that state is guilty of an offense. On several occasions, the Israeli regime consulate in Toronto has advertised that they have an IDF representative available for personal appointments for those wishing to join the IDF. In 2019, the consulate announced an IDF representative will conduct personal interviews at the consulate on November 11th to 14th. Young people who wish to enlist in the IDF or anyone who has not fulfilled their obligations according to the Israeli Defense Service law are invited to meet with him. Subsequently, United Jewish Appeal of Greater Toronto and Federation Combined Jewish Appeal Montreal publicized a webinar last June by Nefesh B. Nefesh titled Joining the IDF, which claimed to offer participants everything you need and want to know about joining the IDF. As part of drawing attention to the recruitment, Justice Minister David Lametti received a formal complaint and letters from nearly 1,500 individuals. Additionally, the Chief of Staff for the Office of RCMP Commissioner Rob O'Reilly received a packet of evidence and 900 emails regarding illegal Zionist regime military recruitment in Canada. The campaign has been widely covered in left Canadian and pro-Palestinian media. Why is the Israeli regime military still recruiting in Canada? Canadians should not be recruited to fight for the Israeli army. Canadians recruited for Israeli war crimes. Toronto schools push students to join Israeli military. What constitutes recruiting? civil society groups demand action on illegal Israeli regime military recruiting in Canada are some of the articles published on the campaign. In Quebec, Le Devoir discussed the campaign on its front page and in a follow-up article, while Journal de Montréal also ran a story on the challenge to the Zionist regime military recruitment in Canada. But in English Canada, the dominant media has ignored the evidence presented to the Justice Minister and RCMP. A number of reporters expressed interest in the campaign, but got cold feet or were stopped by their editors from covering the public letter and evidence compiled. In February, David Mastracchi wrote a powerful article about how media is ignoring illegal Israeli regime army recruitment in Canada. The lack of corporate media attention partly reflects the silence of the anti-Palestinian lobby. Generally quick to denounce pro-Palestinian activists' toxic obsession with the Israeli regime lobby has failed to find fault with a campaign suggesting they are engaged in criminal activity. They understand that publicly denouncing the anti-recruitment campaign would draw attention to an issue difficult to defend. The potential illegality of the recruitment is embarrassing, and promoting a foreign army rests uneasily with an even right-wing nationalist thinking, which is generally sympathetic to an anti-Palestinian outlook. Prominent military historian Jack Granatstein, for instance, told an interviewer, "In my view, no one who is a Canadian should be able to enlist in some other country's military and keep his Canadian citizenship." At the same time, the Israeli regime lobby doesn't want to stop convincing young people to join the IDF. According to 2017 statistics from the IDF, 230 Canadians served in the Israeli military. In 2020, 9% of the lone soldiers in the Israeli regime military were from Canada, according to the IDF. Canadians staff West Bank checkpoints and ships enforcing the blockade of Gaza. About 3,500 lone soldiers serve in the IDF. This is significant, but a relatively small proportion of the 150,000 enlisted in the Israeli regime military. The campaign to oppose the Zionist regime military recruitment in Canada challenges this ideological climate. Bringing the issue into the House of Commons is an important step in disrupting a dynamic where a young Torontonian can be in charge of overseeing Palestinian misery.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Forty recommendations by Imam Khamenei for the journey towards God. If you are into supplication and dua, value time. Plead to God beseechingly and earnestly for great requests. Those of the Islamic Ummah, those of the Islamic country, those of your nation and your personal needs, then make a promise that you will make whatever efforts required to achieve that request and that you are willing to strive for the sake of God. Appreciate the opportunities to make du'as. God will answer these prayers and fulfill their requests. Many of our society's material necessities will be definitely fulfilled, provided that it is a society of piety, du'a, and morality.
رمضان يا شهر القرآن فيك أذوق حلاوة الإيمان لا لا تنقضي أنت للروح دواء رمضان 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 يا حبيب رمضان ليتك دوما قريب
A bad sign. There is a hadith, and I'm not sure if it is narrated from the infallible imams or someone else. But anyway, it is a wise saying that holds, I fear losing the chance to make dua more than I fear my dua's rejection. Sometimes, we miss the motivation for dua. This is a bad sign. If you are not motivated when praying, it is not a good sign. Of course, it can be remedied. We can regain the motivation for dua from God by paying attention, by pleading beseechingly and earnestly. Say whatever your broken desires to say. It is narrated in a hadith that when praying, do not consider your request as big. That is, ask for whatever you want from God. Do not think that it may be too much, and you should ask for less in order to get an answer. We are forbidden from considering our request too much. That is not to consider your request and what you wish for too much before God. Ask God for great things and God will answer your request. Do not get disappointed from praying. Do not close this path and do not lose this means that God has provided His servants with. We are of course advised in the hadith not to precipitate in du'a. If you asked for something and your request was not fulfilled, do not consider that your prayer was not answered. Everything will come to its fate in its time.
Alhamdulillah, Alhamdulillah. All praises to Allah, all praises to Allah.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
the limelight.
Under a Hemeric Israeli regime blockade since 2006, the densely populated Gaza Strip lacks basic services like clean water, electricity, or minimally equipped hospitals. Therefore, long before COVID-19 ravaged many parts of the world, Palestinians in Gaza were dying as a result of easily treatable diseases such as diarrhea, salmonella, and typhoid fever. Dear listeners, stay with us for an article in this regard written by Ramzi Barood, a journalist. This article is published under the heading, A Palestinian Prayer for Ramadan. May the voices of the oppressed be heard. Here's more. COVID-19 cases in Palestine, especially in Gaza, have reached record highs, largely due to the arrival of a greatly contagious coronavirus variant, which was first identified in Britain. Gaza has always been vulnerable to the deadly pandemic. Under a Hemeric Israeli regime blockade since 2006, the densely populated Gaza Strip lacks basic services like clean water, electricity, or minimally equipped hospitals. Therefore, long before COVID-19 ravaged many parts of the world, Palestinians in Gaza were dying as a result of easily treatable diseases such as diarrhea, salmonella, and typhoid fever. Needless to say, Gaza's cancer patients have little fighting chance as the besieged strip is left without many life-saving medications. Many Palestinian cancer patients continue to cling to the hope that the Israeli regime's military authorities will allow them access to the better-equipped Palestinian West Bank hospitals. Alas, quite often, death arrives before the long-awaited Israeli regime permit does. The tragedy in Gaza, in fact, in all of occupied Palestine, is long and painful. Still, it ought not to be classified as another sad occasion that invokes much despair but little action. In fact, the struggle of the Palestinians is integral to a larger struggle for fundamental human rights that can be witnessed throughout the West Asia region, which, according to a recent Carnegie Corporation report, is one of the most economically unequal regions in the world. From war-torn Libya to war-torn Syria to Yemen, Iraq, Somalia, Sudan, Afghanistan, and many parts of the Arab and Muslim world, the dual tragedy of war and want is a scathing reminder of the price ordinary people pay for frivolous power struggles that yield nothing but more uncertainty and achieve nothing but more hatred. Once more, the holy month of Ramadan visits the Muslim Ummah while its tragedies are still festering. New conflicts, unfinished wars, an ever-spending death toll, and a never-ending stream of refugees. Sadly, not even Ramadan, a month associated with peace, mercy, and unity, is enough to bring about, however, fleeting moments of tranquility or a respite from hunger and war for numerous Muslim communities around the world. In Palestine, the Israeli regime occupation often takes even more sinister turns during this month, as if to intentionally compound the suffering felt by Palestinians. On April 14th, Sheikh Mohammed Hussein, the Grand Mufti of Al-Quds and preacher of Al-Aqsa Mosque, called on Arabs and Muslims to intervene so that the Israeli regime may cease its harassment of Palestinians at the holy shrines of Al-Quds, the occupied East Jerusalem. Aside from the increased attacks by Jewish extremists who are now storming Al-Aqsa Mosque at a significantly higher rate than ever before, the Israeli regime occupation authorities have removed the doors of the mosque minarets, cut the electrical wires of loudspeakers to prevent azan or call to prayer, and seized Ramadan iftar meals, in addition to threatening to storm the mosque on the final days of the holy month of Ramadan, Sheikh Hussein said in a statement. The Israeli regime fully comprehends the spiritual connection that Palestinians, whether Muslims or Christians, have to their religious symbols. For Muslims, this rapport is further accentuated during the holy month of Ramadan. Severing this connection is equal to breaking the collective spirit of the Palestinian people. These are only a few examples of a multifaceted and deeply rooted tragedy felt by most Palestinians. Numerous similar stories, though of different political and spiritual contexts, are communicated every day throughout the Muslim world. Yet, there is no meaningful discussion of a collective remedy, of a strategy, of a thoughtful answer. Ramadan is indeed to be a time when Muslims are united on the basis of a wholly different criterion, where political and ideological differences disappear in favor of a spiritual unity, which is expressed in fasting, prayer, charity, and kindness. Unfortunately, what we are witnessing is not Ramadan as it was intended to be, but different manifestations of the holy month, each catering to a different class, a painful but true expression of disunity and inequality that have afflicted the Muslim Ummah. There is the Ramadan of boundless wealth, finely catered iftar meals, coupled with endless cheap entertainment. In this Ramadan, platitudes are often offered about charity and the poor, but little is delivered. There is also the Ramadan of Palestine, Sudan, and Yemen, of the Syrian refugee camps, and of little dingish doting the Mediterranean, carrying thousands of desperate families, holding little but their hope of a better future beyond some horizon. For them, Ramadan is a stream of prayers that the world, especially their Muslim brethren, may come to their rescue. For them, there is little entertainment because there is no electricity, and there are no massive iftar feasts because there is no money. Dua is Arabic for supplication. For the oppressed, dua is the last resort, at times even a weapon against oppression in all of its forms. This is why we often see bereaved Muslims raising their open palms to sky whenever tragedy has befallen them. Ramadan is the month where the poor, destitute, and oppressed raise their hands to heaven, beseeching God in various accents and languages to hear their prayers. They are reassured by such hadith, saying, Prophet Muhammad, as this, the supplications of three persons are never turned away, a fasting person until he breaks his fast, a just ruler, and the supplication of the oppressed, which is raised by Allah above the clouds. The gates of heaven are open for it, and the Lord says, by my might, I will help you in due time. There has never been a more critical time for the Ummah to work together, to heal its collective wound, to uplift its downtrodden, to care for its poor, to embrace its refugees, and to fight for its oppressed. Many Muslim communities around the world are aching, and their pain is unbearable. Perhaps this Ramadan can serve as the opportunity for social justice to be finally enacted and for the oppressed to be heard, so that their hymn of torment and hope may rise above the clouds.
Shura debate.
The conviction of former police officer Derek Chauvin over George Floyd's murder has been branded a turning point in America's history. But what kind of turning point? Has police brutality against blacks decreased, or has it stopped? Has crime decreased at the hands of police in general? Not only did crimes continue, especially against Latinos and African Americans during the trial, after the trial there have been several high-profile police killings. Why this trend continues in the U.S., the subject of this edition of The Debate.
Over the past year, almost 1,000 people have been killed at the hands of U.S. police. According to data compiled by the Washington Post, minority groups account for a disproportionately high chunk of the victims. It suggests African Americans and Hispanics made up more than half of those fatally shot by police in 2020, although these communities comprise 13 and 18% of the U.S. population, respectively. The Washington Post report also says at least 111 children have been killed by U.S. law enforcement since 2015, with over 60% of those kids being blacks or Hispanics. The damning data comes in the wake of harrowing recent incidents of police brutality, particularly against people of color. 13-year-old Adam Toledo was shot dead in a predominantly Latino neighborhood in Chicago on March 29th. Police claim the boy drew a handgun at the end of a foot chase. However, in body cam footage released by the Chicago Police Department, the young victim seems to be raising both of his hands in surrender before getting gunned down. 3 weeks later, another young black girl was killed by police, this time in Columbus, Ohio. 16-year-old Micaiah Bryant was shot dead after police were called to the scene of a brawl. Last Wednesday, and in the most recent incident of police brutality, officers shot a 42-year-old black man 5 times, including once in the back of the head. Andrew Brown Jr.'s family attorney has called his killing an example of execution.
This, in fact, was a fatal wound to the back of Mr. Brown's head as he was leaving the site trying to evade being shot at by these particular law enforcement officers who we believe did nothing but a straight-out execution.
Perhaps the most controversial of all these recent killings is that of 20-year-old Dante Wright. The black man was killed on April 11th during a traffic stop in Brooklyn Center, Minnesota. The incident doubled outrage as court processions were underway in nearby Minneapolis, where an ex-officer was on trial for murdering George Floyd in May last year. Last week, Derek Chauvin was finally found guilty of all charges after a trial that had put the entire United States on edge. Many hoped that Chauvin's conviction would spell an end to police brutality, especially towards minorities. But little seems to have changed, and people, especially African Americans, have to continue their fight against racism and racial discrimination they have endured for centuries.
Okay, let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Debate. We have Abiyomi Azikiwe, who's the editor of the Pan-African Newswire, who joins us from Detroit. We also have from Philadelphia, Yahne Ndogo, social justice activist, joining us. I'd like to welcome you both. Yahne, let me first start with you, if I may, and ask you to please explain what is meant by the guilty verdict when it was announced to have been branded a turning point. Has anything changed since it was branded as a turning point?
Yes, I don't believe that it represents a change, that although people were hopeful that there would be something different that would happen than what we've seen in so many incidents where police officers, or even in the case of Zimmerman, who was not even an officer, individuals who gunned down or in any way murder someone, who is black or brown, that they don't just get away with it and that they don't receive impunity. And that there was a little bit different, but that seemed to be much more of a response to what happened over the course of last year and in the threat of what might happen if there was a guilty verdict. But we saw just while we were waiting for the verdict, Micaiah Bryant was murdered, and the number of police murders have not diminished at all. And so I think that that's propaganda on behalf of the state in order to suggest that people should change and believe and have hope for a transformation. But those kinds of hopes, they no longer can we hold those. We've been waiting for actually decades and generations for there to be some sort of transformation of the system to actually recognize the humanity of all of the people who are in the world, not even just in our own country, because we see the way that the U.S. involves and deals with lives all across the world and with its imperialist efforts that are matched by the efforts that are happening in the country as it relates to the disregard of human life and the prioritization of property. So no, it's not a change.
Okay, there's quite a few things that you mentioned there, which I hope to break down if we have time during this debate. But Abiyomi, when we take a look at some of the stats, this particular one stands out that during the trial, police brutality and killings against African Americans and Latinos, for example, continued and even increased. That throughout the trial of George Floyd's death, killings by police were mounting. What does that say when you have what's termed as a turning point, and yet you have this particular stat, which to many speaks volumes?
Oh, it's definitely not a turning point. I mean, it was important that Derek Chauvin was found guilty on all counts of murder. Yet at the same time, the police have not been changed at all. There's been many, many high-profile cases just since the last 2 weeks. Of course, you mentioned several of them. But unless there's a fundamental change in policing in the United States, which is rooted in the slave system, going back to colonial Britain, colonial Netherlands on the East Coast, colonial France in the southwest of the United States, they, of course, hired slave catchers to pursue enslaved Africans and even Africans who were considered free. For the purpose of incarceration, re-enslavement, harsher forms of exploitation. And of course, this did not change even after the Civil War, the passage of several constitutional amendments and civil rights acts. We could talk about the 13th Amendment, 14th Amendment, 15th Amendment. Since the 1950s, we've had several civil rights acts passed by the U.S. Congress, 1957, 1964, 1965, 1968. Now they're talking about passing a George Floyd Policing Act. Yet, if they don't root out the racists, which is almost impossible to do because they're so deeply embedded within the racist criminal justice system. So the system itself has to be fundamentally changed before we get any real progress in regard to policing in the United States. Now, the Fraternal Order of Police, for example, their leadership said they agreed with the verdict against Derek Chauvin. But at the same time, they are supporting other police officers who are accused of doing the same thing, committing the same type of racist and brutal acts. So the system itself is the fundamental problem.
Okay, so, Yane, I'm jotting down the different topics that are all interrelated and interconnected in a sense, so we can differentiate between all of these if we can, and I'm going to give that task to you. I've jotted down police brutality in general, and then you have police brutality against minorities, African-Americans, Latinos in that group. You have racial tensions in the U.S., our guest, Abiyomi Azikiwe, we talked about the criminal justice system. And you, Yane, said there's a lack of respect for human lives in when it comes to, for example, U.S. policies around the world. Am I correct to break it down in those categories?
I mean, everything that you've mentioned is true. And actually, you know, something that has recently become a part of the news that's going around right now in the U.S. Is related to the bombing that happened in 1985 In 1985, here in Philadelphia, the city administration, the mayor's office and the police department bombed a residence here in Philadelphia that had family inside of it and ended up murdering. There were 13 people inside, two of them, one adult and one child, escaped. The other 11 people, six adults and four children, were all murdered. And this was done also because they let the fire burn, because they shot at the, they were shooting. If people were trying to escape, they would shoot down the alley so they would have to run back into the home. And now we've recently learned that the remains of two of the children, Tree and Delisha Africa, were have been held by the University of Pennsylvania and been transferred and then transferred to Princeton University and have gone back and forth, and they're claiming they're not even sure where those remains are. The lack of regard for the humanity of those individuals from 1985 until this moment is a reflection of the way that the United States, the family had no idea that these remains were being held in this way. They did not give consent, and now they have to be re-traumatized by this reality. And that's a complete disregard, not only to the humanity of the individuals that were in that, that whose bones they have, but to all of the people who cared for them and loved them and who knew them and who thought that they had buried them. And so that's a particular example that's very fresh and for me very personal, because I personally know these individuals who are suffering from this trauma, that demonstrates the way that the structures of the U.S. operate and what they prioritize. And so when you look at the way that the United States engages in its interaction, its foreign policy, there's no hesitation to exact policy that will cause the suffering of hundreds of thousands or millions of individuals to the benefit of the hegemony that the U.S. and Western forces want to maintain. When you look at the way that the U.S. managed the issue around COVID and the massive transference of wealth, the number of people who died and suffered as a result of that is not of importance, because they made trillions of dollars. The wealthy in our nation made trillions of dollars off of, as a result of the way that the pandemic was handled. And everything that is done here, it centers and prioritizes what was prioritized all the way back hundreds of years ago, which was property, or the idea of property and the idea of wealth. That is what the enslavement system was about. And as Brother was speaking earlier, said that is what the police departments are embedded in. And so the system of enslavement is still perpetuated. The 13th Amendment that was mentioned also, it allows for people to be enslaved through imprisonment. And we have more people in prison now than we had who were actually enslaved in the U.S. And so the goal is to ensure that as much can be extracted both from the land and from people as possible in order to maintain power and wealth for the few who are running our system.
Well, let's put a challenge to you, if I may, Abiyomi, regarding what you said, a criminal justice system is broken. But is the criminal justice system broken when, as you said, reflective, for example, when you have results showing that people of color face a higher likelihood of being killed by police than do white men and women? When you have risk of being killed by police, use of force in the U.S. by age, race, ethnicity, to be attributed mostly over whites, attributed to Latinos and African Americans. I mean, those are not a result. That's not a result of a broken criminal justice system. That sounds, at least to me, it sounds like there's a racial discrimination, perhaps, that's happening here. And I'm trying to get at the root of the problem here, whether there are the racial tensions exist, whether it's from the police towards who they go after or amongst people in the U.S. Am I correct to look at it that way?
Yeah, most definitely you are correct. It's rooted in the system itself, the criminalization of African people, indigenous people, people of Latin American descent, and even Asian people and people from the Middle East have been criminalized. We can see now that the escalation in hate crimes against people of Asian descent for no reason other than that they come from Asia. And we saw this in the United States in the aftermath of the Civil War and the failure of Reconstruction. There was a rash of extrajudicial killings known as lynchings. Approximately 5,000 people were lynched in the United States between the 1880s up during through the Great Depression. A lot of them are not even recorded, the lynchings. They are so numerous. And today, we're seeing a continuation of this process. I mean, what happened to George Floyd was a lynching, in my opinion. The same thing with Dante Wright, with Andrew Brown, and with Micaiah Bryant, and Breonna Taylor, so many others that we don't even know about are still being lynched in the streets. They're still being railroaded through the criminal justice system. They're being incarcerated at disproportionate rates in relationship to the number of Africans and people of Latin American descent who are considered citizens of the United States. So this is a systematic program of social containment, economic exploitation, and national oppression. And it's deeply rooted in the profit-making capacity of the United States, because so many people who are incarcerated, they're not just sitting there every day. They're working, they're producing goods and services for the U.S. and the world capitalist system. And so it's clearly tied in with the ongoing profitability of the system that exists here in the United States. And we could even look at the educational system known as the school-to-prison pipeline, where African-Americans and other students of color are disproportionately disciplined. They are kicked out of school. They're not in necessarily curriculums that can capture their imagination and their attention. So you have higher attrition rates among the oppressed groups in this country. So the whole system itself is the root of the problem, and it's going to continue to be that until there's some fundamental change.
Okay, so we're quickly running out of time. I'd like to, Yahane, point out to the U.S. Constitution, where it says, in one case, the 14th Amendment, designed to assure, and I'm reading off here, to the colored race the enjoyment of all civil rights under the law enjoyed by white people, and to give to that race the protection of the general government in that enjoyment, whenever it should be denied by the U.S., by the states, that is. Whenever you go fill out an application, it says that we do not make decision based on race, color, etc. And I'm mentioning this because for a country like the U.S. that is so diverse, and it does have so many races, and is so displays so vividly or so severely the whole idea of multiculturalism, you have these racial tensions that have boiled over now. So there's obviously a system that's broken somewhere. How can this be addressed? Because as it's continuing, when it comes to U.S. police brutality against African Americans, for example, and Latinos, that's continuing, and it's getting worse and worse. So how can this be addressed, in your opinion?
It has to be addressed by the people. The system is actually not broken. The system operates the way that it is intended to. And racism is actually an invention of the system. It's imposed by those who run the system. It's a tool of the system. And it actually is used in order to prevent the people who have the same material interests from coming together, because they are seeing each other as the enemy, and instead of actually seeing where their true enemy is, which is the individuals who are ruling the system that is being used to hurt and harm the majority of people. The majority of the wealth and the resources that are available in the country are not actually accessible, easily accessible by the majority of people. We have, for example, in my city alone, more empty houses owned by the city in order to address homeless insecurity than we have unhoused people, and yet they are still sleeping on the streets all winter long and under all kinds of weather conditions. But instead of fighting against the system, quite often people are fighting against each other. The people have to actually come together. The solution is in the common everyday people who are confounded by the system and confused intentionally, both through the education system, through the news system, and the propaganda machines, to actually have the kinds of tensions that you're picking up on and that you're perceiving. Those tensions are both race-based and class-based. So people can have a sense that they can win inside of the context of the system through a class reality and separate from the other individuals that they are
very
connected.
Well. I'm sorry to jump in. I just want to give the last, squeeze one last question here, and quickly, in 30 seconds, Abiyomi Azikiwe, one interview made that I conducted last week, the guest said there needs to be an armed uprising from African Americans. Is that something that is actually going into the psyche of African Americans in the U.S. because of the way that they're being treated, whether it's through police brutality or otherwise?
Well, people have raised this in the past, during the 1960s and 1970s. I don't think we have to call for it in order for it to be an objective reality. There are more African Americans that are arming themselves, forming gun clubs, and of course the consciousness level is rising due to the level of repression. So I believe that if the system on its own is not able to compromise and bring about fundamental reforms, there's definitely a threat of civil war inside the United States. There's no question about it.
I'm going to have to jump in because we're fresh out of time. I do apologize. Let me thank our guest, Yahne Ndogo, social justice activist for Philadelphia. Thank you for your comments. And Abiyomi Azikiwe, editor of Pan-African Newswire there from Detroit. Thanks for tuning in to another edition of The Debate. From Mikhail Vitaeva, entire team in the capital, Tehran, is goodbye until next time.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.